What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Chapter 20 of The Secret of Lonesome Cove by Samuel Hopkins Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 20. In the White Room. Annalaka, July 15. To Hotel Airy, Martindale Center, Dust 571, and send up 7 chairs. Chester Kent. Now I wonder what that might mean, mused the day clerk of the Airy as he read the telegram through for the second time. Convention in the Room of Mystery, maybe? To satisfy his curiosity, he went up to the room himself. Its white bareness confirmed a suspicion of long-standing. "Any man," he remarked to the scrubwoman, "who would pay 5 a day for a room just to put nothing at all in it, has sure got a kink in his cogs." Nor did the personnel of the visitors who, in course of the late afternoon, arrived with requests to be shown to 571, served to efface this impression. First came the sheriff from Annalaka. He was followed by a man of unmistakably African derivation, who gave the name of Jim and declined to identify himself more specifically. While the clerk was endeavoring, with a signal lack of success, to pump him, lawyer Adam Bame arrived, and so emphatically vouched for his predecessor as to leave the desk lord no further excuse for obstructive tactics. Shortly afterward, Alexander Blair came in, with a woman heavily veiled, and was deferentially conducted aloft. Finally, Chester Kent himself appeared, accompanied by Sedgwick and a third man, unknown to the clerk, pompously arrayed in frock coat and silk hat, and characterized by a painfully twitching chin. "Who have come?" Kent asked the clerk. That functionary ran over the list. "Looks like something to do with the woman found in Lonesome Cove last week," he essayed hopefully. Kent glanced out of the window. "It looks like rain," he observed, "and it looks like wind, and it looks like a number of things that aren't anybody's business. Furthermore, I may mention that we shall not need, in 571, ice water, stationery, casual messages, calling cards, or any other form of espionage." He favored the wilting clerk with a sunny smile and led his companions to the elevator. Sedgwick put a hand on his arm. "The woman with Blair?" he asked under his breath. Kent nodded. "I rather hoped that she wouldn't come," he said. "Blair might better have told her, so far as he knows." "Then he doesn't know all?" "No, and perhaps she would be content with nothing else. It is her right, And she is a brave woman, is Marjorie Blair, as Jax here can testify. We have seen her under fire." "She is that," confirmed the man with the twitching chin. "This, then, is the final clear-up?" asked Sedgwick. "Final and complete." "Thank God! It will be a weight off my shoulders." "Off many shoulders," said Kent. "Here we are." Greetings among the little group, so strangely and harshly thrown together by the dice cast of the hand of circumstance, were brief and formal. Only Preston Jax was named by Kent, with the comment that his story would be forthcoming. The seven guests seated themselves, the Blairs at one end of the half-circle, Sedgwick and the astrologer at the other. Kent, leaning against the wall, fumbled uncertainly at his ear. "I hardly know where to begin," he said, his eyes roving along the intent line. "Not that the case isn't perfectly clear, but there are certain startling phases which—" He glanced toward the Blairs. Marjorie Blair smiled bravely at him. "Don't be alarmed for me, Professor Kent," she said. "What I most want is to have everything cleared up. Everything." "First, your jewels, then." Kent turned to Preston Jax, who handed him a package. Opening it, Kent displayed the wonderful Grosvenor rose topazes, with a miscellaneous lot of rings sparkling amid their coils. With a cry, Marjorie caught up the necklace. "Are all the remainder of the lost valuables there, Mrs. Blair?" asked Kent. She glanced carelessly at the rings. "I think so. Yes, but this is what matters to me. These are all that Preston Jax found on the body." Alexander Blair leaned from his seat the better to take Preston Jax, at the other end of the crescent, under consideration. "It was you who found the body?" he demanded. "Yes," said the astrologer, uneasily. "Were you alone when you found it?" "Yes. No. I don't know. There was a man somewheres near. I heard him, but I never saw him." "Was Mr. Francis Sedgwick with you that night?" pursued Mr. Blair in measured tones. "I never saw Mr. Sedgwick until today." There was a little soft sigh of relief from where Marjorie Blair sat. "That may or may not be true," said Alexander Blair sternly. "It is the word of a man who has robbed a dead body, if, indeed, he did not also kill—" "Steady, Mr. Blair," broke in Chester Kent. "Perhaps, considering who is present, we would better approach this in a somewhat calmer spirit." "I didn't kill or rob anyone." The words seemed to be jerked out from between Preston Jax's teeth by the spasmodic quiverings of his chin. "How came you by my daughter's jewels, then, if you did not take them from the body?" "Whoever said I didn't take them from the body?" retorted the other. "I did take them. But it wasn't robbery. And what I want to know is, how did they come to be on the body anyhow? What was that Astraea woman doing with your daughter's rings and necklace? Tell me that." "Wait a moment," put in Kent. "Explain to Mr. Blair, Jax, what your purpose was in taking the jewels." "To hide 'em. I thought the less there was on the body to identify it, the better chance I'd have of getting away. I was so scared that I guess I was half crazy, anyway. And now, I hear, she never has been identified. Is that right?" Sheriff Schlager half rose from his chair. "Ain't you told him, Professor Kent?" Kent shook his head. "Nor you, Mr. Blair?" "No." "Then I don't see why we can't keep it amongst ourselves," said the sheriff. "Gansett Jim's tight as a clam. Nobody'll ever get anything out of him. And, Lord knows, the less that's known of it, the better I'm suited. I ain't none too proud of my part in it. There is no reason why it should ever be known outside of this room, said Kent, and, at the words, Alexander Blair exhaled a pent-up breath of relief. But it is due to one person here that she should know everything. The question is how to make it clear in the best and the kindest way. If it will make it easier for anyone here to speak, said Marjorie Blair, I can say that I understand certain phases of my husband's past life thoroughly. There is no need to spare me on that ground. But this pertains to a phase that you do not understand at all. Yes, I think so, she persisted gently. This dead woman had some hold over my husband. To maintain it, she came to live near Hedgerow House, and while she was blackmailing Wilfred, she got into communication with Mr. Jax. Perhaps they were in collusion, suggested Lawyer Bain. Oh, no, no, broke in Alexander Blair impatiently. You're wide of the truth. I understand, persisted the young woman, that the woman persuaded or compelled Wilfred to write the letter to Mr. Jax, which she signed Estrella, and that when she went to keep the rendezvous, she took my jewels, which, I suppose, she forced poor Wilfred to steal for her. Am I not right, Professor Kent? No, far from it. Why not? Cried Sedgwick eagerly. She certainly had the jewels on when she met me, and the handcuffs must have been in the bundle. I heard them clink. Exactly, the handcuffs, said Kent dryly. What use, to your mind, would a woman of that sort have for manacles in those circumstances? Yes, put in Adam Bain. They fit in about as nice as a pink silk hat at a funeral. I know what use she had for 'em, muttered Preston Jax, caressing his wrist. It's simply a case of crazy woman, isn't it, Professor Kent? No, not if you mean that your assailant was a crazy woman, said Kent patiently. Then who, in heaven's name, is or was Estrella? Cried Sedgwick. Estrella is, I take it, a lady long since dead. A very strange and interesting lady who adopted that name for her own particular pursuits along our friend Jax's line of interest. They call themselves all sorts of things, observed the astrologer philosophically. I had a follower once that used to sign herself Carrie Nation, and she wasn't the real Carrie at all. No name is sacred to 'em when they go dippy over the stars. Then the woman of Lonesome Cove borrowed that name from some old record? Asked Sedgwick. Follow me through a page of unwritten local history, said Chester Kent, straightening up. The beginning of this story goes back some 75 years, when there lived, not far from Hogs Haven, in a house which has since been destroyed, an older sister of Captain Hogg, who married into the Grosvenor family. She was, from the evidence of the Grosvenor family historian, who, by the way, has withheld all this from his pages, a woman of the most extraordinary charm and magnetism. Not beautiful, in the strict sense of the word. She had a gift beyond beauty, and she led men in chains. Her husband appears to have been a weakling who counted for nothing in her life after the birth of her children. Seeking distraction, she flung herself into mysticism and became the priestess of a cult of star worshippers, which included many of the more cultivated people of this region. Among them was a young German mystic and philosopher who had fled to this country to escape punishment for political offenses. Hermann von Miltz was his name. "That's why she called me Hermann," broke in Preston, in an awed half-whisper. "Don't jump to wild conclusions," said Kent smilingly. "Some of their correspondence is still extant. She signed herself Estrella in handwriting similar to the signature of that note of yours, Jax. There seems to have been no guilt between them, as the law judges guilt. The bond was a mystic one, but it was none the less fatal. It culminated in a tragedy of which the details are lost. Perhaps it was an elopement that they planned, perhaps a double suicide, with the idea that their souls would be united in death. There are hints of that in the old letters in the historian's possession and in the library at Hedgerow House. This much is known. The couple embarked together in a small boat. Von Miltz was never again heard of. Camilla Grosvenor's body came ashore in Lonesome Cove. She was the cove's earliest recorded victim. The sketch which that mischief-monger Elder Dennett left at your door, Sedgwick, supposing it to be a likeness of the unfortunate creature he had seen on the road to your house, is a Charles Eliot sketch for the portrait of Camilla Grosvenor. "My God!" Jax burst out. "Was it a ghost I met up with that night on Hawk Hill Heights?" "As near a ghost as you are ever likely to encounter, probably," answered Kent. "But see here," said Adam Bain. "I'm a lawyer. The law doesn't deal with ghosts or near ghosts. Are you trying to tell us, Professor Kent, that the soul of this long-dead Estrella Camilla Grosvenor came back to inhabit the body of the Jane Doe of Lonesome Cove?" "Not precisely that, either. Everything is strictly within the limits of the law's cognizance, Mr. Bain, as you will see. Now I'm going to make a long jump down to the present. If I fail to keep the trail clear anywhere, you are any of you at liberty to interrupt me. First, then, I want you to follow with me the course of a figure that leaves Hedgerow House on the late afternoon of July 5th. By chance, the figure is not seen, except at a distance by Gansett Jim, who suspected nothing then. Otherwise it would have been stopped, as it wears Mrs. Blair's necklace and rings." "Dressing the part of Estrella?" guessed Lawyer Bain. "Precisely. Our jeweled figure, in a dress that is an old one of Mrs. Blair's, and with a package in hand, makes its way across country to the coast." "To join me," said Preston Jax. "To join you. Chance brings the wayfarer face to face with that gentleman of the peekaboo mind, Elder Dennett. They talk. The stranger asks, quite by chance, though the elder assumed it was otherwise, about the home of Francis Sedgwick. At the entrance to Sedgwick's place the pair met. There was a curious encounter, ending in Sedgwick's demanding an explanation of the rose topazes, which he knew to be Mrs. Blair's." "How did he know that?" demanded Alexander Blair. "Because I had worn them when I sat to him," said Marjorie Blair quietly. "You sat to Sedgwick? For your picture? Why didn't you tell me of this?" "No explanation was due you. It was a matter of chance, our acquaintance. Mr. Sedgwick did not even know who I was."
"Nor who his other visitor was, I suppose," said Blair with a savage sneer.
"No," said Sedgwick, "nor do I know to this day." "The stranger," continued Kent, "refused to give Sedgwick any explanation, and when he threatened to follow, stunned him with a rock and escaped. Some distance down the road, the wayfarer encountered Simon P. Groot, the itinerant merchant. Sedgwick afterward met him and made inquiries, but obtained no satisfaction. Why was Mr. Sedgwick so eager to recover the trail, if he had not murder in his mind, demanded Blair.
"You are proceeding on the theory that Sedgwick, knowing who Mrs. Blair was, and who the strange visitor was, deliberately killed the latter for motives of his own. But Sedgwick can prove that he was back in the house by 9 o'clock, and we have a witness here who was talking with the wearer of the necklace at that hour. Jax, let us have your statement." Holding the copy of the confession in his hand, in case of confusion of memory, the Star Master told of his rendezvous, of the swift savage attack, of the appalling incident of the manacles, of the wild race across the heights, and of the final tragedy. "I've thought and wondered and figured day and night," he said in conclusion, "and I can't get at what that rope and the handcuffs meant." "The handcuffs must have come from that dreadful collection of Captain Hogg's things in the big hallway at Hedgerow House," said Marjorie Blair. "Yes," assented Kent, "and the dim clue to their purpose goes back again, I fancy, to the strange mysticism of the original Astraea. The disordered mind, with which we have to deal, seems to have been guarding against any such separation as divided, in death, Astraea from her Hermann." "But Chester," objected Sedgwick, "you speak of a disordered mind, and yet you've told us that it isn't a case of insanity."
"Never," contradicted Kent. "You've misinterpreted what I said. In the early stages of the affair, I told you, if you remember, that a very bizarre situation indicated a very bizarre motive. What could be more bizarre than insanity?"
"Was it suicidal insanity, then?" asked Bain.
"Not in the ordinary and intentional sense."
"Then it was the other man that killed her," said Preston Jax. "The man I heard yell when she went over. But what became of him?"
"Simon P. Groot spoke of hearing that man scream, too," confirmed Bain. "Have you got any clue to him, Professor Kent?"
"The other man was Francis Sedgwick," declared Alexander Blair doggedly. Chester Kent shook his head. "I've got a witness against that theory from your own side, Mr. Blair," said he. "Gansett Jim at first thought as you do. In that belief he tried to kill Mr. Sedgwick. Now he knows his mistake. Isn't that so, Jim?"
"Yeah," grunted the half-breed. "You were out through the countryside that night trying to trace the wanderer."
"Yeah."
"And later, when I showed you the footprints at the scene of the struggle, you saw that they were not Mr. Sedgwick's?"
"Yeah."
"You examined the cliff for footprints. Do you think anyone pushed or pursued the victim over the brink?"
"No."
"Whose were the footprints that you found, Jim?" demanded Alexander Blair. The half-breed pointed, in silence, to Preston Jax.
"Of course. His and the others. But there were the marks of a third person, weren't there?"
"No."
"There must have been," insisted Mr. Blair. "Are you positive?"
"Yeah."
"Then did the other man, the man whom Jax heard cry out, walk without leaving any trace?"
"There was no other man," said Chester Kent. "Don't you understand, Mr. Blair," he added with significant emphasis, "the source of that cry in the night heard by Jax and Simon Groot?" A flash of enlightenment swept Blair's face.
"Ah," he said in a long-drawn breath. "Then, I was wrong. I beg Mr. Sedgwick's pardon."
Sedgwick bowed. Marjorie Blair's hand went out, and her fingers closed softly on the tense hand of her father-in-law. No third person had any part whatsoever in the drama which Jax has recounted to us," pursued Kent. "In the morning the body was discovered. Sheriff Schlager was sent for. He found in the pocket something that betrayed the connection of the body with Hedgerow House. A bit of writing paper with the heading still legible," said the sheriff. With this he accosted Gansett Jim, who after a night-long search had come out on the cliff. Jim, assuming that the sheriff knew all, told him of the identity of the body. The sheriff saw a chance for money in it. If I do you an injustice, Schlager, you'll correct me. Go right ahead, don't mind me, I'll take my medicine. Very well. Schlager adopted the ready-made theory which Mr. Jax had prepared for him, so to speak, that the body was washed ashore, and arranged, with the connivance of Dr. Breed, the medical officer, to bury it as an unknown. For this perversion of their duty, Mr. Blair rewarded them handsomely. As I understand it, he dreaded any publicity attaching itself to Hedgerow House and his family. God knows I had suffered enough of that, murmured Blair. Let us hope it is now ended. To avoid this, Mr. Blair was willing even to let the supposed murderer, whom he believed to be Sedgwick, go unscathed of justice. By chance, however, I saw the body on the beach. The most important discovery of all, I missed at that time very stupidly, the more so in that I had a clue in the character of the assault upon Sedgwick, but I could not overlook the fact that the corpse had not been washed ashore. Moreover, the matter of the manacles stimulated my interest. Not until the inquest, however, did I realize the really startling and unique feature of the case. There is where you and Dr. Breed made your fatal error, Mr. Sheriff. That's right. You saw the face when we lifted the lid, I suppose. No, you were too quick in replacing it. Then how did you get on to the thing? From seeing the face after the body was returned to the courtroom. Hold on a bit, interrupted Lawyer Bain. I remember there was a fuss about the corpse not being publicly shown for identification. Some of us insisted. The sheriff gave in. The coffin lid wasn't quarter off when Breed gave a yell and clapped it on again, and they took the body back to his house and shut themselves in with it for half an hour before they took it to the hall again. Naturally, being suspicious, I looked at it pretty close, but I didn't see anything queer. Possibly you didn't notice a cut on the cheek? Suggested Kent. Yes, Dennett spoke of it, and the sheriff shut him up. But what of it? It might have been done in any one of a dozen ways. But it wasn't there when the body lay on the beach. In the rolling and tossing of the journey there might easily be minor scarifications, said Sedgwick. True. But, Frank, what did you suppose that sudden shift on the part of the officers of the law meant? Perhaps that the body was not in fit condition to be viewed. In that case, what could they have done to make it more fit? Nothing, I suppose. I didn't consider that. I rather opined, said Lawyer Bain, that someone had changed bodies on him. "That's what made you so cussed curious, was it, Adam?" barked the sheriff. "There was no exchange of bodies," said Kent. "But there was a change in the body itself." "What kind of a change?" asked Sedgwick. "Has it ever occurred to you to think that after death the hair grows fast?" "I've heard it said," said Lawyer Bain, "that it grows faster than in life." "And that it grows not only on the head, but on the face as well?" "The face? A woman's face?" exclaimed Sedgwick. "No, a man's." "What man?" "The man in the coffin." "Have you lost your mind, Chet? The body in the coffin was that of the woman who met me at the entrance to the nook." "No, it was the body of the man who, dressed in woman's clothing, met you at the nook, and knocked you down with a stone flung overhand, as not one woman in a thousand could have thrown it. That, in itself, ought to have suggested the secret to me long before I discovered it." "But how did you discover it?" inquired Sedgwick in bewilderment, "since you didn't see the growth of beard on the dead face yourself." "By the cut on the cheek. You see, the sheriff had failed to foresee that telltale beard. So, when in deference to Mr. Bain's protest against burial without a formal view of the body, they opened up the casket and saw the obvious change in the face, there was nothing for the officials to do but remedy their carelessness. They had the body taken to the house and did the best they could. That cut on the cheek was a razor cut. Having realized that much, I had to deal thenceforth with the mystery of a dead man masquerading as a woman and being abetted in the deception by the officers of the law." "Astrea, a man?" broke in Preston Jax, his chin in a spasm. "No wonder he put up such a fight. Who was he?" "My son, Wilfred Blair," said Alexander Blair. Sedgwick took a swift, involuntary step toward Marjorie, but Kent was before him, setting a firm hand on his shoulder. "Not now, Frank," he said. Then, turning to the girl widow, "You see, Mrs. Blair," he said very gently, "it isn't so bad as you feared. There was no other woman in the case, no disgrace, no shame. You need feel nothing but pity for an unhappy, wrecked mind, for which death was the happiest refuge." Marjorie Blair sat very still and white. "Let me think," she whispered. "Let me think." "But the man's voice," exclaimed Jax. "The voice of the man on the cliff." "Wilfred Blair's," said Kent. "In the final moment he came to himself. At last he resumed his voice. Up to then he had been, in voice, manner, thought, purpose, unconsciously playing a part." "Astrea," said Sedgwick and Jax in a breath. "Yes. It was one of those strange and complete assumptions of personality which puzzle the alienists. Wilfred Blair's diseased mind had fastened upon a strange history of his ancestress, and brooded on it until he became convinced that her spirit was reincarnated in himself. Undoubtedly, his striking likeness to the portrait of Camilla Grosvenor powerfully aided the obsession. There were her letters in the library to give color to his unconscious imitation. As is common in this form of dementia, he was secretive. But there can be no doubt that from the time when he recognized in Preston Jax's advertisement the call of Estrella's kindred soul, Hermann von Miltz, his one overwhelming desire was to reenact the drama of the last century in his own assumed personality. Jax has told us how cleverly and secretly the plan for the double suicide was matured. This obsession must have been of long standing. "We thought it melancholia," said Alexander Blair. "As you say, he had been very secretive, very silent, too. We kept Gansett Jim with him as a sort of bodyguard." Marjorie Blair got to her feet. She was ghost white,
but her voice and eyes were steady as she faced Kent. "I must understand this all," she said. "Wilfred's body is where?" "In Annalaka churchyard." "Then who, what is buried in his grave at Hedgerow House?" "Nothing," said Alexander Blair. "A mock funeral?" "My dear," said the man. He seemed to have grown suddenly old under the unspoken arraignment. "I could not tell you what I thought the truth. I thought then that Wilfred had encountered Mr. Sedgwick, and that there had been a fight in which he was killed. Rather than face the scandal of a murder trial, a scandal in which the family name would have been dragged through the mire of the public prints again, I chose the part of deceit. I'd have bribed 100 officers of the law rather than have had you dragged to the witness stand and have been compelled to give testimony myself. There has been enough of public shame in my life." "But you made me believe that Mr. Sedgwick killed Wilfred," she accused. "I believed it myself," he retorted. "But what basis had you for suspecting me of the crime?" cried Sedgwick, turning to Marjorie Blair. "You didn't know of his visit to me in woman's clothes. You knew nothing of the quarrel, it seems, until just now. For what possible reason, in your belief, should I have killed him?" She flushed to her temples. I thought," she murmured, "that he might have known of our acquaintance and have misconstrued, that he might have gone to find you and attacked you, and that you killed him, in self-defense, I mean." "Thank you for that last, at least," said Sedgwick rather bitterly. Then, as he saw her wince, "Forgive me," he added in a low tone. "But to be suspected by you, even though you were misled—" He stopped, catching Kent's frowning glance. "Who discovered that the burial was a false one?" she asked after a pause. "Professor Kent," said Blair. "He and Mr. Sedgwick exhumed the coffin." "That was the night," her eyes questioned Sedgwick, "that I found you at Hedgerow House, yes," he said gently. "And that my father-in-law charged you with being my husband's murderer." "My dear Mrs. Blair," said Kent uncomfortably, "remember what justification he thought he had." She considered a moment. "You are right," she said with an effort. "I don't mean to be unjust." Her head dropped in thought. "Whatever Wilfred may have been," she continued, after a moment's silence, "he was my husband. I bear his name. And to leave him in a nameless grave is to dishonor not him alone, but myself." "You would claim the body?" cried Alexander Blair. "What else is there for us to do?" she countered. "And bring down upon us unavoidably the publicity which we have escaped at so bitter a price?" cried the elder Blair. "Have we not suffered enough from the scandal of his life that we should be further involved in the scandal of his death?" "He's right, miss. It won't do," said the sheriff kindly. "Silence is best," said Sedgwick. "What the papers would do with this," opined Preston Jax, "would be a plenty." "My advice is to let be," proffered Lawyer Bain. "Yeah," grunted the half-breed. "Oh, are you all against me?" she cried. "Mr. Kent, you too? Do you think me wrong?" "No," said Kent. "Will you drag our name, hers as well as mine, in the mud?" cried the head of the House of Blair. "No," said Kent again. "But how, then?
Tell me what you intend—"
"No," said Kent, and with such absolute flat finality that the others looked at him in blank silence. The silence was broken by a tremendous sigh. All eyes turned to Preston Jax, who had risen and was leaning against the wall, his chin jerking galvanically.
"Well?" said Kent.
"What about me?" asked the Star Master miserably.
Kent's fingers twitched at his earlobe.
"Well, what about you?" he repeated. "What are you going to do with me?"
"You? Oh, you go back to Irene," said Kent, with his half-smile. "That's your sentence, if Mrs. Blair approves."
The astrologer drew a quick breath. The light of a great relief softened his hard little eyes. A startled look widened them as Marjorie Blair, her own trouble forgotten for the moment, rose and went over to him, the reflection of another's happiness shining in her face and making it doubly lovely. A ring glinted in her outstretched hand.
"Take this," she said softly, "for your Irene. May you be very, very happy together." For the space of 5 seconds, Preston Jax's chin was motionless. Then a minor cataclysm convulsed it. Speech emerged from that facial quake, in a half-stutter, half-blubber, wholly absurd and laughter-provoking and heart-moving.
"What'll I say? What'll I do to thank you, ma'am? I'll just tell you this. It's me for the straight and narrow from now on. And if ever you or Professor Kent or any of you want an A1 special chartered extra-celestial star reading for self or friends, you come." He made a rush for the hallway, and the door banged a period to his emotion.
"I think," said Chester Kent gravely, "that lesson will last."
As Marjorie Blair stood smiling, soft-eyed, at the door whence the overcome Star Master had disappeared, Sedgwick started to pass. With quick and unexpected tact, Alexander Blair drew the sheriff and the lawyer aside, giving to the young people their moment. She looked up at Sedgwick with lifted eyebrows.
"Are you not going to speak to me?" she said sorrowfully.
"What is there to say, except one thing, and that I may not say now?"
"No, no," she whispered in a fright. "But say you forgive me."
"You? For what?"
"For having believed, even for an instant, what Father Blair said, that you were the murderer."
Sedgwick smiled bravely. "That is all past."
"And you'll think of me at least kindly?"
"I'll think of you with every beat of my heart," he said passionately.
Across her face passed the look of fairy wistfulness that was all her own.
"No," she said, "it would be better for both of us that you should forget for the time."
He leaned over her.
"What shall assuage the unforgotten pain and teach the unforgetful to forget?" he quoted very low.
"And yet," she persisted, "it would be easier now that I am going away."
"Going away? For long?"
She nodded with compressed lips. Sedgwick turned very white.
"Oh, don't look like that," she faltered. "I can't bear it. Can't you see that after what has happened, I must go? I must have time to forget. There is so much to forget. Surely you can be patient and trust?"
Again he smiled at her with a courage shining through his pain that brought the quick tears to her eyes.
"Yes, I can wait and trust and love."
Again he leaned to her.
And think how she, far from me, with like eyes sees through the untuneful bough the wingless skies. He drew her gaze to his own, held it for the space of a heartbeat, and was gone. End of chapter 20. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 21 of The Secret of Lonesome Cove by Samuel Hopkins Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 21. Rewards. Summer had waned from the coast, and with it had passed the keenness of local interest in the strangest victim of Lonesome Cove. Even the indefatigable tongue of Elder Dennett had almost ceased to clack on the topic by the fall of the first snow. Other subjects of absorbing interest supervened during the long winter: the wreck of the schooner yacht off Dead Men's Eddy, the coming of the new Presbyterian minister at Martindale Center, whose wife was reported to be a suffragette, the mysterious benefaction that had befallen old Mrs. Orcutt late in February, enabling her to leave her home next to Annalaka churchyard and take her asthma southward in search of a cure, the rumor that Hedgerow House was to be sold before summer. "And young Blair's body along with it, I expect," remarked the elder malevolently. "Seems to me, if I was a millionaire like Alexander Blair, I wouldn't sell my own flesh and blood, dead or alive." Of Alexander Blair himself, nothing had been seen in the neighborhood since mid-July, nor of his daughter-in-law. Hedgerow House was in charge of Gansett Jim as caretaker. Professor Kent had left about the same time as the Blairs. But Francis Sedgwick had stuck to the Nook, studying first the cold grays and browns of November, and later the wonderful blazing whites and subtle blues of drift and shadow spread before him in winter's endless panorama, with the same enthusiasm that he had devoted to October's riot of color. Though the work prospered, the worker had paled. It was the opinion of Martindale Center and Annalaka alike that the painter feller was looking right peaky and piney, like one whose conscience ached. But Sedgwick had nothing worse than a heartache, and the fates were making medicine for that. Windborne on the blast of a mid-March gale, Chester Kent dropped down at the door of the Nook one wild afternoon, without warning. As always, he was impeccably clad, though his stout boots showed the usage of recent hard wear. Leaving Austin that morning, with his light valise slung to his shoulder, he had footed the 15 miles of soggy earth to Sedgwick's place, in a luxurious tussle against the wind. Throwing open the door, he called his friend's name. Instantly the artist came loping down the stairs and had him by the shoulders. "I've got a caller up above," he said, after the usual greetings and questionings were over. "Yes? Have you gone in for local society?" "Not exactly local. It's Alexander Blair." "Hello!" said Kent in surprise. "What brings him?" "Why, he came down to Hedgerow House to look after certain books and papers, and ran over here to make his amend honorable in form. Chet, I hate being apologized to." "Of course, everyone does. Nevertheless, it's good exercise for Mr. A. Blair, Esquire. Brings into action some muscles of his soul that might otherwise have atrophied from disuse. He's the grim-jawed, hard-bitted Blair of old. Just the same, he made his apology as handsomely as need be. I'll bring him down here." The fabric magnate descended from the studio and greeted Kent briefly, then turned to his host. "You will excuse me if I ask Mr. Kent to step outside. I have some business with him." "Stay here," said the artist.
I'll go back to my studio," which he did. "When a man once declines employment with me," said Alexander Blair to Kent, "I never give him a second chance. That rule I am going to break. I need your assistance."
"Honored, indeed," murmured Kent. "Will you accept the commission?"
"Not if it is like your former offer."
"It is not. It is bona fide. Someone has been tampering with my son's grave."
"You mean the grave at Hedgerow House?"
"Yes. Gansett Jim reports that there are signs of recent digging. It looks as if ghouls had been at work there, with the idea of getting the body and holding it for ransom. They would have had a fine surprise if they had got the coffin out."
"Because they'd have found no body in it, you mean?"
"Certainly. But suppose they discovered that there were no remains, nothing but a punctured sandbag. Do you see the potentialities of blackmail?"
"No."
"Then you are stupider than I ever took you for," growled the magnate. "Like most things, it depends on the point of view. I don't think that you are in any danger of blackmail. But, if I understand the matter, you want your mind relieved of anxiety on the point. Very well, I'll take the case."
"That is settled, then," said the older man briskly. "Now, this being a strictly business deal, we will discuss terms."
"Oh, there is no room for discussion as to my terms," said Kent easily. "I make them, and you accept them, that's all."
Alexander Blair's eyebrows drew down in a heavy scowl.
"Do you know of an old lady named Orcutt in Annalaka?" pursued the scientist.
"No."
"She owns the house just next to Annalaka Churchyard, where your son was buried as Jane Doe. She is a very worthy old lady, but she suffers severely from asthma. In fact, it keeps her awake most of the night. So some interested persons have subscribed money and sent her south to a sanatorium. I'd like to get you interested in her case."
"You wish me to subscribe?"
"Oh, more than that. I think it would be a good idea if you were to assume the entire expense of the proceedings."
"You mean reimburse the subscribers?"
"Exactly."
For a few seconds the millionaire studied Kent's candid face.
"Very well," he agreed. "How much?"
"Sheriff Schlager can tell you. He is keeping the accounts. You see, it was necessary to get her out of the way. Her windows overlook the churchyard."
"So you took occasion to indicate before."
"Repetition of a really relevant point is excusable. She left 2 weeks ago, very much mystified, but pathetically thankful, poor old girl."
"She has no monopoly on being mystified," observed Mr. Blair with pursed lips.
"Probably she never will understand. That's where you have the advantage of her, for I think you'll see quite clearly the reason for her trip and the propriety of your footing the bills."
"Go on."
"When she was safely out of the way and no longer overlooking Annalaka Churchyard by night from her window, Schlager, Adam Bain, and I paid a visit to the place. Technically, what we did there amounts to grave robbery, I suppose. But we covered our tracks well, and I don't think anybody will ever discover what has been done."
"Well?" queried his hearer with twitching jaw.
"What lay nameless in Annalaka Churchyard," said Kent gravely, "now rests in its own place at Hedgerow House. The marks found by Gansett Jim were made by us. So your alarm is groundless. But I wish that you might have heard the little prayer made by that simple country lawyer over your son's grave. Once in a while I meet with a really through-and-through good man like Adam Bain,
and then I have to reconstruct my whole formula on the average cussedness of human nature." Alexander Blair's clenched hands went to his temples in a singular gesture and dropped again. "What interest did Schlager and Bain have in the matter?" he added in a low tone. "Why, Schlager had done some dirty work for you, and wanted to even accounts with his own conscience. As for Bain, we needed a third man we could trust. I asked him and got him. It was no small risk for him. If you felt that his risk is worth some reward, you might—" "Yes, yes," interrupted the other eagerly. "Do you think a thousand, or perhaps more?" Kent smiled. "By thinking hard, I could think a thousand," he said. "But not more, in this case. It wouldn't be safe. Bain might not survive the shock. Thank you very much, Mr. Blair." "And now," said the older man, "I am still in the dark as to your interest in the matter." "Mine? Why, for one thing, I dislike to leave any affair unfinished. I have the satisfaction of knowing now that this is forever settled and done with. Besides, there was a promise, practically a promise, as near a promise as I often permit myself to go in a world of accidents, errors, and uncertainties, made to Mrs. Blair. Is she back from Europe?" "She is at Hedgerow House." Blair communed with himself for a time, then said abruptly, "By the way, do you think your friend Mr. Sedgwick would come over to a pick-up dinner before we leave?" Kent's face lighted up. "Ask him," said he heartily, "and see." "I will as soon as I get home. Good day." Blair hesitated. He seemed to have difficulty in going and embarrassment in staying. He coughed and cleared his throat, looked over Kent's head and down at his feet, and finally got himself into words. "Kent," he blurted, "I realize now why you won't take my money. I can always buy brains, but I can't buy the bigger, better thing. It isn't in the market. Thank you." He caught the scientist's hand in a swift, hard grip and strode off down the road. Chester Kent went back into the house with a glow at his heart. He shouted upstairs to Sedgwick, "Go on with your work, Frank. I want to loaf and invite my soul for an hour. Where's your reading matter?" "Shelf in the corner," answered the artist. "You'll find a few things in your line. Darwin's Origin of Species, Leconte's—" "The devil take Darwin," cried Kent impiously. "I want Bab Ballads, or Through the Looking Glass, or something like that, really fit for an aspiring intellect. Never mind, I'll forage for myself." 3 minutes later he was stretched luxuriously on the divan, with the window shade pulled down and the big electric chandelier glowing, immersed in the joyous nonsense of Rhyme and Reason. The wind alternately shouted profane protests at the window because it couldn't get in, and then fell silent, waiting for an answer. In one of these lulls, Kent heard footsteps outside. He dropped his book. The footsteps approached the window. Then the gale rose again, and the loose end of a garment flapped softly against the glass. He half rose, listening. There was silence outside. "Have I fallen into another mystery?" groaned Kent. "Is there no rest for the weary?" The footsteps mounted the side porch. Kent awaited a knock. None came. "Odd," he observed to his pillow. "Few people find the outside of a door so fascinating that they stand for 2 minutes in a wet gale admiring it." Tiptoeing to the door, he threw it open. There was a startled cry from without and an equally startled grunt from within.
Chester Kent and Marjorie Blair stood face to face.
I beg your pardon, gibbered Kent, whelmed instantly in a morass of embarrassment. I didn't mean to frighten you.
Feminine-wise, she built up her self-possession on the ruins of his.
I wonder, she said with a smile, whether I'm the worst frightened one of us.
You see, he said lamely, it was so sudden, your coming that way. I didn't expect you.
And for that reason you intend to bar me from the house? It's quite disgustingly wet out here.
With a muttered apology, Kent stepped aside, and she entered. Even amid his ill ease he could not but note how the girlish loveliness had ripened and warmed, yet without forfeiting anything of that quaint, appealing wistfulness which made her charm unique. But there glinted now in her deep eyes an elfish spirit of mischief, partly inspired by the confusion of the helpless male creature before her, partly the reaction from the mingled dread and desire of the prospective meeting with Sedgwick, for she had come on a sudden uncontrollable impulse to see him, and would have turned and fled at the last minute had not Kent surprised her. Perhaps there was a little flavor of revenge for this, too, in her attitude toward him.
"What a surprise to find you here, Mrs. Kent," she remarked sweetly. "Or are you calling yourself Mr. Blair nowadays? And how is your poor ear?"
Chester Kent immediately seized that unoffending member and clung to it with much the lost and anguished expression of the pale martyr in the once popular Rock of Ages, Chromo. His tormentor considered him with malicious eyes.
"Did any woman ever say boo to him suddenly, I wonder?" she mused aloud.
Like a saving grace, there came into Kent's mind a fragment of The Hunting of the Snark, in which he had just been reveling. Said he gravely, "He would answer to hi, or to any loud cry such as fry me or fritter my wig."
She caught up the stanza, "To what you may call 'em, or what's his name, but especially thingamajig."
"So you know Lewis Carroll. How really human of you."
"It is better to be humane than human," murmured Kent, relinquishing his oral grip as he began to touch bottom.
"Is that a plea? Very well. I shall be very gentle and soothing. But oh," she burst out irrepressibly, "may the kindly fates give me to be among those present when you fall in love."
Kent favored her with an elaborate bow.
"Your presence would be the one essential."
"Really," she approved, "you're progressing. I begin to feel repaid for my visit already."
This time Kent looked her in the eye. "You're not very demanding in the matter of returns for your trouble," he remarked. "To come through all this wind and rain and then be content merely to contemplate the outside of a door, that argues a humble spirit. To be sure, however, it's a very good door, one of the most interesting features of our local architecture, and may lead to all sorts of things."
It was her turn to grow red.
"You haven't asked me about Sedgwick," he continued.
"Is he well?" she inquired formally, but with quickened breath.
"He is more than that. He is cured, and a man. A man," he added meaningly, "for any woman to be proud of."
There was a step on the floor above. Marjorie Blair's hand went to her heart.
"I didn't know he was here," she panted affrightedly. "I came just to look at the place. Then I saw the light, and I wanted so to come in, but I didn't dare. I can't see him now. I must go. Don't tell—"
Chester Kent raised his voice. "Frank," he called,
Come down here, quick." Not twice in his life had Sedgwick heard that tone in his friend's voice. The bungalow shook to his long tread across the floor. The studio door opened and flew shut behind him. He took the stairs at a leap, and on the landing stopped dead. "Marjorie," he whispered. She shrank back a little from the light in his eyes. "What do you do here?" he said very low. Still she did not speak, but stood tremulous, her face half panic, half passion. Unobtrusively Kent slid along the wall like a shadow and vanished into the night. "Where have you been?" Sedgwick asked the woman of his love. "Everywhere, nowhere. What does it matter?" she faltered. "I've come back." He went forward and took her hands in his, cold little hands that clung as they touched. "Why did you never write me?" he asked gently. "I don't know. I couldn't. Don't ask me to explain. It was just that I felt I must come back to see you as I had come to you first, unexpected and without a word. Can you understand?" "No," he said. "No, I suppose not. A man couldn't." "Good God!" he burst out. "Do you realize what it is to live in such a hell of uncertainty and longing as I've lived in since you left? To wait and hope and lose hope, and hope and wait again for a word that never comes? To eat your heart out with waiting?" A slow, wonderful smile trembled on her lips. "My dear," she said, "I have waited for you all my life." Suddenly her arms were around him, her cheek was pressed to his own, the breath of her whisper was at his ear. "Oh, forgive me. I will make it up to you, my dear, my dearest." Out in the wind and the rain, Chester Kent drew in the deep breath of satisfied and rounded achievement. He had beheld, against the wide window-shade, two shadows which, standing motionless for a moment, a few feet apart, had drawn slowly together as by some irresistible magnetism, and suddenly merged into one. The unintentional eavesdropper nodded in grave gratulation to the house, then turned away. "Finished," he said. "C'est conclu. Fini. Telo. Das Ende." And any or all other words of whatever language meaning a sound conclusion. Half an hour later he entered, with due preliminary stamping of mud from clogged feet. Instantly Marjorie went over to him. "Why, you're wet as a rag," she cried, with a sweetly unconscious assumption of proprietary interest. "You must go and change at once," she added, patting his shoulder. Kent reached for his ear, changed his mind midway, and scratched his nose. "All right," he said meekly. Over his rather stern-set face there came a singularly winning smile. "You too," he said. "That's as it should be. That's worth everything." "No other congratulations will ever sound so good as that, Chet," said Sedgwick in a low voice, "or so unselfish. You've had all the heat and toil of the great game, and I have all the happiness." "Not quite all, I fancy," returned Kent, smiling at Marjorie. She took his wet hand between her own. "But it doesn't seem quite fair," she protested. "Frank and I have found each other. But you, who have fought our battle for us so splendidly, what reward do you have?" Chester Kent shook his head. "My dear," he said gently, "the great game isn't played for prizes." The End. End of Chapter 21.
Recording by Roger Mleen. End of The Secret of Lonesome Cove by Samuel Hopkins Adams.